U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change, Todd Stern. He is the head of the U.S. delegation here in Copenhagen. He will begin with some brief opening remarks, and then we'll go to your questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Susan. Hello, everybody. Thank you all for coming. I actually just arrived in this very lovely city a little while ago, and I'm pleased to be here, pleased to have a chance to appear before you, and pleased to be part of the U.S. delegation, which I think is an extraordinarily strong one. I know Lisa Jackson did an event today, which I heard was very well received, as it should have been. I actually flew in with Secretary Ken Salazar of the Department of Interior, Secretary Tom Vilsack from the Department of Agriculture. So we have a strong team and more coming. The bottom line here is the United States is committed to getting the strongest possible agreement we can over the next 2 weeks. We are under no illusion that this is going to be easy. I think it's going to be challenging. But I think an agreement is there to be had if we do this right. And we need to keep at all times very much in sight of our and keep in our view the end goal that has brought us here. I think the President has demonstrated a strong commitment to this issue from day one. He came into office focused first and foremost on the economic stimulus package to get the economy going, but in that package he embedded $80 billion of green investments and incentives, a huge amount for the United States. You can compare that against an average of about $3 to $4 at the most billion dollars in R&D in an ordinary year. We put in place through the EPA the highest vehicle standards, strongest vehicle standards we've ever had back in March. EPA has acted again just in the last, well, in the last few days and in the last month to move to start being in place to regulate stationary sources of CO2 like power plants and the like. And we have a comprehensive energy and climate bill legislation that has moved through the House and is pending in the Senate now and that we've been pushing hard. But the United States commitment is strong. We have, as I'm sure you're all aware, articulated a U.S. target within the last couple of weeks of 17% below 2005 levels by 2020. That ramps up. That's part of an overall legislative package that goes out to 2050. But just to give you an example, by 2025, the reduction would be about 30% below 2005 and 42% by 2030. And if you compare that to 1990 levels, because there are some who favor that baseline, in 2025 we'd be 18% below 1990, in 2030 we'd be 33% below 1990. So it's an aggressive package that the President has put down. We are also supporting the kind of fast start funding that was part of the Commonwealth Declaration about a week or two weeks ago. That would ramp up to $10 billion collectively of developed country contribution by 2012 and move on up from there. Also, as you know, President Obama is going to be attending the conference here coming at the end of it. Obviously, action by the United States or action by the entire developed country group is not nearly enough. We need, and it's going to be a core part of this negotiation, to have significant action by the major developing countries. There is no question that that we have, and the United States has, the largest historic role in emissions of greenhouse gases, and we have said this all up and down our administration from the beginning of this year. But it is also true that virtually all of the growth in emissions going forward, nearly all of it, is going to come from developing countries. The IEA estimates 97% is going to come from developing countries between now and 2030, and 50% from China alone over the next 20 years of the growth in emissions. So there's simply no way, if you care about the science, and we do, there is no way to solve this problem by giving the major developing countries a pass. We are not talking about the same kind of need for action from the vast majority of developing countries, but from the major ones, it's going to be absolutely essential. And it's essential that they step forward and set forth the actions that they're prepared to take, make clear that they're going to stand behind those actions, and make the implementation of those actions transparent in a way that you see in many arenas all over the world, whether it's the WTO, the IMF, the Financial Action Task Force, or any number of other bodies where developed and developing countries participate. So let me stop there. Take your questions. Again, the object here and our commitment here is to try to get the best deal that we can, the best agreement we can, to set the world on a path to sustainable development. So let me stop there.
I'd like to ask you please to raise your hand and identify yourself by name and news organization before you ask your question. Here in the front row. Please, two seats in. Thank you.
Marcus Hoy from BNA. The U.S. has said that it won't sign an agreement based on the Kyoto Protocol, but if things head in that direction during COP15, could there be circumstances under which you would agree to an agreement based on the KP. And could you outline any circumstances under which this may happen?
We're not going to become part of the Kyoto Protocol, so that's not on the table. And I think that there are, it depends what you mean exactly by an agreement. If you mean basically taking the Kyoto Protocol and putting a new title on top of it, we're not going to do that either. But there may be elements of the Kyoto Protocol that in effect are similar to what's being discussed in the context of on the so-called LCA track. So I wouldn't rule that out. But we're not going to do Kyoto, and we're not going to do something that's Kyoto with another name.
Third row back, first seat in, please.
Hi, Andy Repkin, New York Times.
Hi.
I got to follow up on that a little bit. You know, there are the key mechanisms and concepts enshrined in the Kyoto Protocol that have always been presumed to be the kind of thing that would be expanded and made more ambitious as a way to make an efficient global agreement, trading of some kind.
Right.
So when you say what you just said, are you saying that it's possible there still could be some mechanism of that sort?
Sure. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there certainly are elements of Kyoto, as like you said, trading and offsets and things like that at least in some form we would see being part of an ongoing agreement.
China has said pretty straightforwardly they're ready to act if we pay for it, essentially. So, you know, you've said it's absolutely imperative that they act, but what about the money part? Is the U.S. and other major developed countries setting down a sort of a marker also for what they expect in terms of what will help finance versus what they'll have to do on their own?
Well, as I said, we think that the kind of initial first several years funding proposal that's part of the Commonwealth Declaration makes sense. We would think that would be aimed fundamentally at the poor countries, the poorest countries, probably focused very much on adaptation, some on forestry as well. I don't envision public funds, certainly not from the United States, going to China. I mean, I don't think that's there is inevitably a limited amount of money. The amount ought to be as high as it possibly can be, but it's necessarily going to be limited. That's just life in the real world. So we would intend to direct our public dollars to the neediest countries, and China, to its great credit, has a dynamic economy that has led it to sit on some $2 trillion of reserves. So we don't think that China would be the first candidate for public funding.
Good afternoon. Malcolm Dowden from LexisNexis.
Yep.
I'd like to ask about the context in which you're negotiating, your domestic context, and in particular the recent decision by the Court of Appeal for the Second Circuit, which said that the courts can essentially step in and impose caps on carbon emissions for a couple of reasons. One, it's not something that's reserved to Congress. Secondly, because the field of regulation is not currently occupied. If you have that prospect of judicial intervention to impose caps as a matter of tort, is that something you feel is a pressure?
Look, I am aware generally of the decision. I haven't read the decision. I think it's interesting, to be sure. I think inevitably this is an issue that's going to be settled legislatively. Of course, regulation has a role as well, and regulation would implement anything that's done legislatively. And it's a backstop even beyond that. But our and the president's absolute commitment and preference is to push forward with the kind of comprehensive energy and climate legislation that has made its way through the House and that's pending in the Senate now. And that's the way this thing ought to get, this issue ought to get handled, not by, you know, 100 judges in different parts of the country, half of them making one decision and half of them making another decision on something that is of this nature.
We have a question in the front row. Gentleman with the blue shirt on, please.
Thank you. David Korn from Mother Jones Magazine and Politics Daily at ALL.
David.
Hi, Todd. Good to see you. Yesterday, Jonathan, in an off-the-record briefing, Jonathan Pershing, said that he thought a political deal in some ways was more advantageous than a legally binding treaty because it could start immediately with the steps you took. With that in mind, and if that's the course that you follow in the negotiations, do you have any sort of timeline or goal for actually arriving at a legally binding treaty if you come out of here with the deal but not a treaty?
Yeah. Well, let me say first of all that our objective from the beginning of this year was a legal treaty. That's what our submission back in April envisioned, and that's what we were seeking. I think sometime in the last, I don't know, couple of months, the Danish Prime Minister, I think, had a view of this, which I think is quite on target. Looking at the nature of the formal negotiations, that it was looking less and less likely that was going to happen. Not that it was a preference that it not happened, but just that the realities were such that it was not so likely to happen, and that we had to focus, therefore, on getting a strong result here in Copenhagen and to make a strong first step in the direction that we're all trying to take. So we're very supportive of that. It's not that we came in not trying to get treaty. We came in looking for a treaty, but as things have developed, that was not in the cards. I do think that there is with respect to the kind of politically binding agreement that the Danish Prime Minister Rasmussen has been talking about. There is an advantage that an agreement can take effect right away, and I think that's probably what Jonathan was referring to. And I think that is a plus. It's not you wouldn't. Throw the treaty aside in order to do that if the treaty was available, but the treaty is not available right now. In terms of going forward, we certainly would intend to, we think the last thing we would want is for the political or politically binding agreement that we're talking about to substitute for the effort to get a legal agreement. So we certainly are supportive of the notion that efforts to negotiate a full legal agreement should go on full speed ahead. I can't tell you exactly what the deadline ought to be, but it ought to be soon.
We had a question in the front row, and then we'll go to the other side of the room. A woman with a black jacket on, please.
Yes, Deborah Berling from Globo Brazil. A lot of the developing countries are insisting that the U.S., Japan, the Europeans commit money here already in Copenhagen individually. Do you think, taking into consideration that your economy is in a pretty bad state, do you think your government is able to commit any money here? And just a quick on the China. China has been saying that your emissions are still growing. They grew 16% from 1990 to 2005 and keep on growing, and that your offer is not sufficient. Thank you.
With respect to your first question on money, I think that the United States will be prepared to be part of an overall solution that involves financial contribution, and that's what I was referring to with respect to the $10 billion, which is also part of the statement that the White House put out in announcing the president's decision to come on December 18th. That's a number in the 2010 to 2012 timeframe, and we would, whether it's individually articulated contributions or it's a developed country contribution where everybody's fair share kind of gets sorted out. I think it may well be the latter, but either which way, it's real money from the United States, from Europe, from Japan, from everybody else. So I think that will be part of the equation here. I would expect that. With respect to our emissions, it's true that our emissions have gone up since 1990, and the president's program, the president's announcements, his activity all the way through this year, and the legislation that's pending, and the 17% ramping up in the way that I described is exactly intended to address that. Let me say, the country whose emissions are going up dramatically, really dramatically, is China, and that's the reason that we can't have an agreement that doesn't have a real commitment by China. I mean, right now China's the biggest emitter in the world. By 2020, it's going to be 60% larger than the United States. By 2030, it's going to be 80% larger than the United States. It's going to be something like 28% of the world. It's 20% of the world total now. It's going to be something like 28% of the world total by 2020. You can't even think about controlling this problem without having significant action by China. So, our emissions are pretty much flattening out right now, and then they're going to go down. China's, I'm not being critical. I mean, China has an extraordinarily successful economy, and it's in a different stage of development than we are. But emissions are emissions. You just got to do the math. This isn't a matter of politics or morality or anything else. It's just math, and you cannot get to the kind of reductions that we need globally if China's not a major player. It's just the reality.
Fifth row back, gentleman with a blue shirt on.
Hello, I'm Alessandro Torello from Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal. Just to refer to developing countries and mainly the major developing countries, many of them have come up with some kind of target or commitment for the future, energy intensity compared with GDP or some sort of commitment. You saying these commitments are not enough for, let's say, China, for example, or India, or some of these commitments are enough? Thank you. And one other thing, the European Union negotiators, just before you, mentioned that mainly, again, developing countries, the G77 group, is not allowing a complete negotiation on mitigation by developed countries at the LCA level. I just wanted to see what your comment on that would be. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the second question.
The EU negotiators said that developing countries are preventing a full negotiation on mitigation targets for developed country at the level of the LCA. So I wanted to see what your view on that is. Thank you.
Well, let me take the second question first, because I don't know. I literally just got here and managed to take a shower and then come over here. So I don't. If there's activity like that going on in the LCA negotiation, I just don't know. With respect to your first question, look, I completely agree, actually, that one of the interesting things, and I've said this many times, If you look around, it's one of the things to be optimistic about, actually, in the long run. I hope in the short run also. Is that if you look around at what countries in the world, including the major developing countries, are doing, they're actually doing a lot. China put down a number. It might not be the number that everybody would like to see, but it's a significant proposal. Brazil has put down a significant proposal. The Indians are also doing that. I have every expectation that South Africa will. Indonesia did, etc. What is important if we're going to get an international agreement is not just that people announce things domestically, but that they announce things domestically and in effect put them into the international agreement, that they become part of the international agreement, not just that it's a press release domestically. So they need to be in an international agreement. They need to be in an international agreement in a fashion that the country represents that it's going to stand behind those commitments, those actions, and implement them. That's one thing. The second thing is, and it's very important, is that there needs to be transparency. I mean, and that's for two reasons. There needs to be transparency so everybody can have confidence that everybody else is undertaking what they said they were going to do, A. And B, there needs to be a sense of where the whole world is going with respect to emissions. So we need to be we can't be in a world where transparency is just trust. Right? Trust us, you know, we'll tell you what we're doing. There's got to be some kind of consultative type process that allows countries to look at each other and get confidence that everybody's doing what they say they're doing. So those things are important. But your underlying question is very important. This is very significant because I'm not saying that what's being proposed isn't good enough. I think that there are a lot of good proposals out there. But if we're going to have an international deal, they've got to be wrapped into an international agreement. That's got to be part of it.
We have time for two more quick questions. In the front row, three seats in, please.
Hi, Steve Kerwood from Public Radio International.
Hi, Steve.
Hi there. Welcome to Copenhagen.
Sunny Copenhagen.
two questions quickly. First, when you came to Bonn originally, you got a standing ovation. What does the United States have to do for you and Mr. Obama to get a standing ovation on your arrival? And then on the Kyoto Protocol mechanisms that are being discussed here and numbers, there's legislation on the Hill. For example, in Waxman-Markey, there envisions a purchase, say, through RED and other mechanisms of another 8% of reductions, that is, in the marketplace. So the 17 would become a 25 under that legislation. How do those numbers figure into your negotiations? And Susan said we have to keep this quick.
I got a standing ovation in March, and I remarked to one of my colleagues that I think I've just peaked. I thought it would be unlikely that I would get another one, and I think that prediction is probably going to be true. The president has gotten more than his share of standing ovations, and I it would be wonderful if he got one here. But mostly we're not worrying about standing ovations. We'd like to get a deal done. With respect to the question about elements in the bill, like the set-asides that you were referring to, you're absolutely right. There are provisions in the House-passed bill that would actually plus up the U.S. target. It would result in the U.S. target being even higher than the 17% than we're talking about, and maybe a good deal higher. That would be based on provisions that would set aside actually a quite large amount of allowances that would be auctioned and the revenues then used to support international forest preservation, which would in turn translate into a lot of tons saved and a higher target for the United States. And in addition, there's some other accounting elements of the bill that aren't worth bothering you with, but that would also increase the total. We're not counting those in our 17 right now because this is legislation that's in process. It's pending in the Senate. They're going to be exactly how the offset provisions get worked out at the end of the day. We don't know. So I don't like to promise things that aren't in my pocket. And so we hope that those provisions get included. The target we put down is explicitly described as being provisional on our legislation. If the legislation goes through in all of the right ways that I'd like to see it go through, then we'll be able to report to the Secretariat, God willing, in the spring, that our target's even higher. But we don't have that yet.
Last very quick question. Gentleman in the first row in the middle with a brown shirt on.
Hi. Last night, Lumumba D. Aping of the G77 described the target of $10 billion a year for developing countries as wholly inadequate, enough to buy coffins. You accept the historical emissions of the United States? Do you accept the sense of a climate debt that's being thrown around? A climate debt that the United States owes some sort of reparations? And is the United States prepared to go further, considering the seriousness of this problem?
I actually completely reject the notion of a debt or reparations or anything of the like. I mean, let's just be mindful of the fact that for most of the 200 years since the Industrial Revolution, people were blissfully ignorant of the fact that emissions caused a greenhouse effect. This is a relatively recent phenomenon. So now I think that's the wrong way to look at this. We absolutely recognize our historic role in putting the emissions in the atmosphere up there that are there now. But the sense of guilt or culpability or reparations, I categorically reject that. Now, with respect to the issue of financing, that's an important question. We think, particularly with the poorest countries, but not only, that there are real needs. I mean, there are real needs all over the world that need to be met. And there are, look, I have said on many occasions that we shouldn't be looking at this agreement simply as an agreement to cap emissions. We should be looking at this agreement as a development agreement and an agreement to help countries that are in an earlier stage of development develop in a way that is sustainable. And the only sustainable development that is possible in the world that we live in now is low carbon development. Low carbon and sustainable are one and the same thing. So we absolutely see this as a development agreement. We absolutely respect and honor the needs of developing countries all over the world for support. We want to be part of that solution, but it's not a question of reparations.